Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles, recorded in our writer's studio just above the bookshop at Kilometre Zero in Paris. If you enjoy these conversations, there are a few different ways you can support us. First of all, you can leave a rating right now in whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings we get, the more likely it is that people will discover us. It only takes a few seconds and can really help spread the word. You can also buy books, gifts, and apparel from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, where you'll find our popular Year of Reading subscription, 12 books handpicked by our dedicated booksellers, shipped to you or a loved one wherever they are in the world. Finally, you can become a friend of Shakespeare & Company by joining the association we set up to get us through a difficult few years. Membership gives you access to exclusive online content, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Find out more at friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. I'll be back at the end, but until then, sit back and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. Something Out of Place is Emma McBride's first book of non-fiction, and is possessed of all the passion, originality of thought, and erudition that readers have come to know in her novels. Beginning with the sentiment of disgust with which, McBride argues, society regards and treats women, it develops into a blistering and astute polemic against the patriarchal framework that oppresses, coerces, sculpts, controls, and all too often ends the lives of half the world's population. Sinead Gleeson described Something Out of Place as a fearless, interrogative work that speaks so much to structural inequality and misogyny, while Stuart Kelly, writing in The Scotsman, called it a fierce, clear-eyed examination of the myriad ways in which women are objectified, adding that it was remarkable. I'm delighted to say that Emma McBride joins me today to discuss it. Emma, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Hi, Adam. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you here, if only virtually. I think before we begin to talk about the grist of the essay, as I said in the introduction, this is your first book of nonfiction. Obviously, you've published articles and essays before. Now, anybody who knows your fiction will know that it's not fiction which could be called necessarily sort of polemical fiction. Like, you don't come out of it as a reader thinking, okay, the point of this book was to say X, Y, and Z. But at the same time, I think perhaps like all fiction, but more so in your case than in other books, it's definitely in certain ways political fiction and feminist fiction. Like, I think there's definitely something in the way you write and the perspectives you choose and the voices you inhabit that has a sort of a feminist thrust to it, has a sort of a political urge. So what I'm curious to ask about is, why did you feel the need to go from the kind of the novel form to the essay form to express the thoughts that you express in this book?
Well, you know, I suppose, like everything I write, it wasn't really a decision. It was the Welcome Collection approached me and asked me if I would be interested in writing something for them on a subject of my choosing. And I suppose I was very fond of Welcome Collection because I had spent several years temping there back in the olden days before I could get published. And so I had a think, and I realized that this idea of disgust was something that had been floating around in my head for a few years, and that actually this might be the moment to try and pin it down, try and unpack it a bit, try and just to see really if it was just something in my head, or if it was, you know, something else out in the world that other women experienced, or if I could, you know, pin it to to some other ideas. So yeah, it was really a kind of a confluence of things rather than a decision to step away from fiction.
And we'll come on to specifically the subject of disgust in a moment, but just resting with the idea of an essay. So you say early on, this is simply an essay, a collection of thoughts, not an objective work of academic research, and so by its very nature subjective. Was there a moment when you were sort of drawn more one way than another? Like you thought perhaps for the investigation of disgust, you might need to do something a little bit more academic, you know, with sort of, I don't know, with more footnotes and more references, and to really sort of delve into, I don't know, the literary history of disgust. And what was it that drew you more towards the kind of the essayistic, the sort of subjective perspective?
Well, you know, possibly laziness, for a start. I don't, you know, I don't come from an academic background. I didn't go to university. I don't have that in my blood. And it's something that I always feel quite anxious about approaching. And I also didn't really think that that was where I had something to offer. I didn't have those kind of skills, and I don't have that ability to unpick at a minute level. I think I, you know, my job as a novelist is to look at the world and see what I see. And I suppose I was thinking that I would approach this in a similar way, albeit with having to do quite a lot of reading to back it up. So it wasn't purely just, you know, me having my say into the world. And also because I thought, yeah, there are academics who can do this and can do this better than I can. What might be interesting is perhaps for a woman in her mid-40s to look around her life, experiences of her life, and the society that she grew up in, the culture that she lives inside of now, and simply point to some of the things that kind of prick at her. And that's, I suppose, what I mean by it being very subjective, in that it, it was really a matter of me following my nose rather than following a program of thought or a program of research.
Yeah. It's interesting because what it put me in mind of, actually, it threw me back to my university days, was that it's sort of, I've seen it described as sort of a manifesto. And when I hear the word manifesto, I think of it more in a sort of traditionally kind of political term of kind of, these are points of how things should change. And it's not that kind of book. And yet it did put me in mind of that more sort of traditional form. And I mean that in quite a complimentary way, because I'm very drawn to these kind of books, the kind of thing that you might find in sort of, well, the Communist Manifesto of Marx, or like Rousseau's Discourse on Inequality, which is sort of, you know, that idea of, oh, man is born free and yet everywhere is in chains. And that, why is this? And let's investigate this. And so you kind of begin with a concept, an observation, and then try and sort of unpick it, unravel it, understand it from sort of one person's perspective, hopefully therefore kind of opening out to a more sort of generalized view on something. And so for me, it's sort of, it fits very nicely as kind of a modern version of those kind of, sort of traditional sort of political treatises.
Yeah, I think so. I certainly didn't set out with the idea of organizing a program for change, because it's really a book about noticing and about questions, rather than about answers and solutions. Because I'm not someone who has ever felt that they are in a position to tell others how to live. But there are works that have profoundly influenced me that are a lot about just teaching, that taught me to notice. And that actually to notice and to engage with something uncomfortable is often as much solution as you will get, because no one person can take down a system, can create a new way of women, in this case, being in the world. But it, you know, I thought a lot about, which again is an academic book, is incredibly well researched, which is the opposite of this book, which was Susan Faludi's Backlash. Which was a book that really taught me as a young woman, I maybe read it in my late teens, early 20s, just to look at the world in a different way, to look at the messages that the media were offering to me and to interpret them in a different way, to not simply take everything at face value. And I suppose that, rather than all the work and all the years she slaved over it, putting academia to her academic brain to good use. It was that idea that sometimes someone can just show you a place, a direction to look in. And once you've looked in that direction, you can't unsee what you saw there, and you carry it with you. And that becomes a filter through which you interpret your experience. And so, it's very much comes from that, and from my, you know, from my own completely subjective view of looking at the world.
And was that sort of that sense of being unable to unsee something, was that kind of how this concept of this kind of origin concept of disgust kind of arose in you? Like once you'd had the thought or the realization, or you'd noticed women or the female body being treated with disgust in sort of society, that did you suddenly then start noticing it in this context and that context? And it's just sort of like, it was almost impossible not to see it in the whole structure of society.
Yeah, absolutely. I think once you begin to see something, you then pick up the threads of it elsewhere. You recognize it in other places. And it seemed to me that disgust was an incredibly powerful but discreet tool of oppression against women. And you know, perhaps my kind of Irish Catholic upbringing made me more alert to it than someone, you know, who'd grown up in the C of E in the UK. But I think the kind of the subtle messaging that underpins so many things, that leads one inevitably down the lane of to the point of self-disgust, I recognized it. You know, and I thought this is operating outside of a religious context. This is operating all over the place, and this is going into institutions. It is going in through interactions. It is, you know, right throughout social media. It is all over the press, and maybe it's time to say it out loud, because the point about disgust is, of course, the shame that it brings upon the person who is the subject of disgust, who has created a sense of disgust in others, and that makes it incredibly hard to tackle head on.
Can you remember the first moment that you articulated to yourself, or the first situation, or the first context in which, you know, from which this kind of system of thought sort of sprung out of? Or was it more kind of ambient thing?
I think it was completely ambient, and it was kind of slightly ridiculous. I remember quite a few years ago now, sitting watching TV, and an ad came on for some kind of foot cream, which had very attractive young woman on it, and then showing her cracked heels and saying, "Are you ashamed of your cracked heels?" And I thought, "Oh my god, now heels, everything else, but now heels I have to be ashamed of and feel disgusted by the sight of my own heels, having dry skin." Like, this is, and it was the beginning of the idea of just grasping the ridiculousness of it, but the extent of it, that you know, to sell some foot cream, a woman is supposed to feel ashamed about her feet. Not just, "Hey, if your feet are a bit sore, put some of this on. This might help."
Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah.
But where is your sense of shame about your feet? We can help you with it, but, you know, you have to own your shame about it before we can help you with our amazing cream. And that just, it just seemed to exemplify so many other things. And ever since then, I have just always been much more alert to that kind of message, the endless sort of, you know, "Oh, you're a disgrace, but we have a solution. Here we go."
There's one thing that really struck me while reading the book was this sort of, was the force of disgust, actually. The sort of the taboo nature of it. Like once this disgust is provoked in one, whatever the cause of it, it is something physical. It's something that sort of, it's not just a sort of a question of taste, something which one would rather not see or something. It's really something that possesses the whole being, and actually, you know, provokes sense of kind of nausea and wanting to sort of put some distance between oneself and the thing. And that sort of, it really came across to me while reading the essay, was the sort of the power, therefore, of the of disgust as a kind of, as a sort of a means of control of half the world's population.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's not something, because it is something which is more, which is physical, which is visceral, which is a bodily reaction. It can't be argued out of, it can't be rationalized. If you walk past a pile of vomit on the street, there is no conversation in which that will stop being disgusting to you. That is the nature of it. And I think it just seemed to me that so many conversations around women for centuries have been tailored towards creating this idea that their natural bodily functions are disgusting, that therefore the nature of woman is disgusting, that one can only be revolted by menstruation, by lactation, by menopause, by women's bodies doing just the stuff that women's bodies do, because that's, you know, their biological function, and that women have no say over. I can't not have my period. That's, you know, that's my body. Unless I do something radical to myself, that's what my body is going to do until the time when it stops doing that. And yet there has been built this kind of vast system of taboo all around all of those functions. You know, and I was very aware when I was a child, you know, of you know, my mother, after she gave birth, had to be churched before she was allowed to come back into the church and take communion, because the female body giving birth was considered to be unclean. And if that's the atmosphere you grow up in, and everyone you know does, and everyone you're ever related to has before you for generations, that is cumulative, and it takes an awful lot to deconstruct that level of negative reaction.
Yeah, just as this kind of a side point on that, the Catholic upbringing, which you mentioned earlier as well. Do you think, in a way, for the sort of the deconstruction, that gives you, in a strange kind of way, a sort of an advantage? Because I think of the more sort of mild-mannered, less kind of overt, but still very much present disgust one might find in the Church of England, or society at large, in fact, where sort of, you know, in the Catholic Church, it's clearly articulated, you know, women's bodies unclean, these processes dirty, you need to be purified, etc., etc. Whereas, you know, that's sort of openly sort of rejecting of women and their bodies. Whereas in the kind of society in which we live now, it's sort of more pernicious in a way. It's sort of all of these forces are still there, but because they're buried, because there's sort of certain veneers put over them, in a sense, perhaps that sort of makes them more difficult to unpick.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, you know, which is why I wrote the book. And, you know, despite having mentioned the fact that I was reared Catholic twice already in this podcast, there's not a great deal about that aspect of it in the book. And that's not really what the book is about. I think that was just perhaps gave me a heightened sensitivity to it, because that was, you know, there was a more dramatic way that I was reared into those notions. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is completely secularized and accepted and quiet, but my God, but still punishable by death, you know, by social death, by media death. You know, should the body dare to be different to social norms? Should, you know, I mean, you can see even in this last week, poor old Linda Evangelista talking about being disfigured by a cosmetic process that she's been through, and the immediate race to get the photo, get the picture of her, so we can all look at it and be revolted by her and go, oh, she's so brave, poor her, but oh my God, look at her face, isn't that you know?
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is also a method in which disgust is filtered through to all of us. That where, you know, now, as long as we say, oh, well, terrible and brave and you're beautiful, even if you're not beautiful anymore, you know, that then somehow we don't have to deal with the underlying issue of why does the body have to be in this way? Why does this mm-hmm. woman's body have to appear in this way? And why are we appalled by it being different to what it has been? And that's, you know, it's, that's a microcosm of what happens to all women all the time. Mm-hmm. Why is the body like this? Why is it fun? Why is it changing? Why is it doing all of these things?
Yeah. When you mentioned earlier sort of the concept of disgust, and you mentioned, for example, the vomit on the street, like there's no way that could ever be anything other than disgusting. It did make me put me in mind of the title of the book, because in the case of like the example with the vomit, it's true, like it's perhaps with the, I don't know, the exception of maybe a biologist whose specialization is studying the human, you know, bilious system, maybe there it's not disgusting, but like that broadly we can say like vomit in every context, pretty disgusting. Whereas the title of your book, so Something Out of Place, there's this idea that one of the underlying kind of motivating things for that disgust is the sort of the fact that sort of women's bodies are not where they should be and not be doing what, you know, not be doing what what is prescribed for them. And yet there's this kind of strange contradiction at the heart of it, is that what that where the place is never really sort of described. So they, you know, women are perpetually out of place wherever they are.
Yeah, and this is the kind of the central idea, I suppose, of the whole essay. And it's you know, it comes from the anthropologist Mary Douglas's book Purity and Danger, in which she examines notions of disgust and why disgust becomes, or why taboo becomes useful in certain mm-hmm. times and places, and how when it stops being useful, it's sort of dissipated. And it seemed to me to apply, you know, beautifully to the situation for women. So, you know, her idea that, you know, a piece of cake on a plate is not disgusting, but a piece mm-hmm. of cake lying on the toilet floor is disgusting. The cake mm-hmm. is still the cake, but where it is has somehow made it disgusting. And that seemed to me a perfect analogy for the situation that women are in, that, you know, everywhere we go, we are seen to be infiltrating spaces mm-hmm. that we don't belong. And of course, you know, the last century or so of kind of radical change in the domestic situation of women getting the vote, of women, you know, being able to divorce, of abortion, of contraception, of you know, equal rights in the workplace. This is really only 100 years of change, and there's millennia of tradition behind that is still pressured, and that is still pushing against all of those things. And there is still a mindset that if only women would stay within the bound. Okay, we accept they'll come to the workplace, but mm-hmm. we should be able to put our hand up their skirt in the workplace. Oh no, we're not allowed to put our hand up the skirt in the workplace. Okay, well, we should be able to make a dirty joke mm-hmm. about them. No, okay, well, we should be able to make a dirty joke with them. No, mm-hmm. we're not allowed to. And it, you know, and that it just creates a further kind of resentment and anger. And so, you know, there's an acceptance of, well, we can take this bit, we can take this bit, but each time women are ruining it for everyone. Mm-hmm.
And also, it's sort of the title, of course, put me in mind of that old sort of expression, you know, a woman's place is in the home. And the kind of the irony underlying that is that often the sort of the home, the sort of domestic environment was essentially a prison for women who were there. Like exactly. It was a prison of you know, labor and childcare and often sort of abuse as well. And so sort of like even the place that is for women isn't really their place. It's not their place in that they can feel comfortable in it or feel at home there.
I think this is you know, the perpetual difficulty for women, because there is no one place to go to, and there is no one great place that we came from that mm-hmm. we can look back and go, well, what we would like is things to be a bit more like that. what we would like is to return, you know, for instance, when we, you know, someone like Maya Angelou talking about the experience of being Black and a kind of an idealized notion of returning to Africa, that this was, and to an idealized Africa, that this was the place where things would have been better, and her experience and it being different. And but women don't even have a place like that anywhere, you know, Black women, white women, Asian. There is nowhere for any of us where times were good and life was easy and equality was had. And so in a way we are constantly always fighting for the next and discovering more, and not necessarily all aiming towards the same end point, but certainly all understanding oppression when we see it. But it makes for a very jumbled forward motion, which is not easy to sustain a kind of a coherent push forward. And I suppose this is why you see so many different splinterings in the feminist movement. There are just people who have different priorities and who want different things. So it's the place we come from isn't great, but the place we're going to is also unknown.
Yeah, and that's one thing that is very clear in the book, is that sense of, you know, pushing forward. You mentioned just a moment ago the last 100 years, and, you know, it's, of course, there are sort of moments of sort of identifiable, well, I don't know if you say progress or improvement, particularly in the Europe and, you know, the West for women. And yet there's also, you know, there was a short period, I don't know, maybe in the sort of the early 2000s, when perhaps broadly people thought, okay, we're done with that. You know, we figured this out. You know, there's equality now. And, you know, that was, of course, a very naive thought then. But I get the sense that in the last few years, particularly, there's either been, I don't know if we'd say it was a regression, or there's certainly been sort of an upsurgence in the kind of, from the kind of the patriarchal framework to sort of to reestablish itself, or to regain the losses that it's suffered.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the kind of, obviously, in the 90s, there was the whole kind of surge of the Ladette movement, which was supposed to be great, which is like, now we can smoke bags and drink pints with the lads, and that's equality, right? And then, of course, that got turned into, and now I have to make fun of fat girls and sit with my legs spread on the cover of FHM, and that's equality, right? Because I'm in on the joke. I'm, you know, they sort of post-feminism started to wander through, persuading us all that we had nothing left to be angry about, and that if we were angry, we were just sour or ugly and unhappy that we weren't getting the attention that other women were getting. And it, I think it had a very powerful effect, because it has a very shaming effect. Because, you know, you're the one who's spoiling the fun for everyone, right? By saying, I actually, hang on, I'm not quite sure how this is. How is this feminism? How is all this porn surging through everything? How is this feminism? Because some women watch it, that makes it feminist now, does it? Oh, I see. No matter how women in these images and on these films are being treated. And, you know, the endless kind of push towards, everything's okay, what else do you want? You've got it all now. Stop complaining. And the quieting down of everything that then came up as soon as Me Too arrived, which was, yeah, not fun, actually, always having to be the butt of the dirty jokes. Not fun having an employer who thinks that they are entitled to you and that you're being a spoiled sport if you don't give them what they want. Or who takes what they want from you and holds it over you and frightens you into seeking justice for that. And that, you know, it became really clear that, you know, women again had been sort of separated out. It was like, you know, they managed to pull people off into various groups and keep them quiet and keep them disconnected from a wider sense of, actually, as a group, we are being mistreated. We are being asked to accept behavior which is not acceptable, which would not be doled out to men in society. And so, you know, Me Too kind of changed all of that and allowed women to be angry again. I think women were, you know, the permission to be angry. Like, we can't have all of these angry women. You can speak nicely, you can watch your tone and tell us nicely what's wrong, but don't get angry and don't make demands, and definitely don't refuse, and don't refuse en masse. And Me Too changed that. I think, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be dealt with in the post Me Too world, like what now? What now? Is it enough to say? What happens after that? Has it changed things? Are institutions changed by that experience? Mm-hmm. And that's going to, you know, that's going to have to be worked through as well. But I think women are certainly more aware than they have been in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, fourth wave feminism was a bit like, oh, sure, it's grand. Let's all be nice to each other, and I can wear mini skirts and stripper heels and have a laugh and, you know, make sure that you feel okay about your masculinity, because men need to be taken care of. And that's feminism for me, because it makes me feel empowered to dress like a hooker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's that, you know, that back and forth is, and those kind of strange double messages are things that, you know, women are constantly bombarded with and struggle to unpick.
Yeah. One thing that makes me think of is in the way you write about sort of the technology and the effect of the recent changes in technology have had on the way women are perceived and the way women are able to manifest as well, to protest against the way things are. And like, I think often what, you know, technology seems to be presented as kind of a black and white thing. Either it's been a liberating thing. I mean, I remember in the sort of when, for example, the Arab Spring started, there was suddenly this idea of the sort of the Twitter revolution. And then that soured very quickly. And I think the last few years, particularly, there has been a sense of sort of the damage that technology causes to across society, actually. So when I say technology, I mean, of course, you know, the sort of social media, Web 2.0, all that kind of stuff. And you present us, I think, a more sort of nuanced perspective. And for example, you were just talking about Me Too then, and it strikes me as that is, and I suspect it's your sort of your love of language that prevented you from calling it the hashtag Me Too movement or something like that. But this was something which was driven by social media and the dynamics of social media that, in a sense, allowed it to gain an ampler, which it probably wouldn't have been able to do 20 years previously. And yet you also mentioned the kind of the pornification of a lot of our society, and, you know, the access people have to pornography, the quantity of pornography people seemingly consume, the nature of that pornography as well, which from what I understand has been sort of whittled by the algorithm to be sort of very sort of specific types of kind of to appeal to kind of the most, the, let's say, the as much of the sort of the male base urges as possible in one video, if you like. So there seems to be, like, to your mind, there's this sort of double edge, I guess, to what technology has done for women and the feminist movement.
I think the idea, obviously, at the beginning of social media was a kind of democratization of information, but also of the ability to make connections with others, to circumvent all the procedures of kind of mass media and all of their biases and all of their prejudices and all of their agendas, and to communicate directly with others. And that, you know, has become, you know, that has been hugely betrayed by everything that we have learned about Facebook and Twitter, and how the algorithms, you know, pointing people in particular directions, picking up on things and pushing certain ideas. And so we can no longer view these things as direct access. And I think women, you know, very clearly come out on the hardest end of of this, because it's become a form in which to attack, and rather than to converse, women making a point, women having an opinion, women daring to be seen at all, to show themselves or to try not to show themselves, it's just opening the door to madness. Mm-hmm. And you see endless kind of rape threats and murder threats over the slightest points of disagreement. And it's hard to understand how women can deal with it without this becoming a legislative issue, which I think inevitably it must, without, you know, basically shutting up and closing down their accounts. This is another place where women are now out of place by being heard, by being seen. And the nature of the way the conversation is had on social media, so it's no longer a debate about ideas. It's who is a good person and who is a bad person. And what do we all together do to bad people? Let's all go at them right now and decide that everything about this person is a disgrace and deserves to be destroyed. And yet at the same time, as you say, Me Too was something that was completely enabled by social media. And there are lots of points where women can meet and discuss, and the idea of the body positivity movement is something that very much came out of Instagram. But you know, straight away, as soon as anything becomes a point of conversation, the brands move in, things become co-opted, everything gets shrunk back down to more traditional and acceptable ways of looking, being, you know, speaking. And women's places are again crushed down, and trying to be larger than that, than the space to which it is believed you are entitled.
Yeah, there's a feeling that almost as of these things like the Me Too movement or the body positivity movement, like they have taken root in social media, but sort of also almost despite the sort of the algorithms and the tides that are at work, rather than because of them, in a sense. Like they sort of these movements have used these tools, but the tools, that doesn't mean that the tools are necessarily conducive to the movement. It just happens that the tools
and the tool is not necessarily on their side. And will not act as a support, and certainly do not act as a buffer, and take no responsibility for what goes on their forums. Yeah.
You put me in mind of also, there was somebody talking specifically in the context of comedy, but of this sense of part of the problem on social media as well, is that so much of it is unseen, and that sort of, so this male comedian was saying that he would, you know, come in for some criticism for things that he said, but it would always be in a kind of, on the sort of the front level of Twitter, if you like. But he said one thing, who friends of his, women comedians, that you don't get to see unless you kind of delve into the threads, is that as soon as they post something, or as soon as they appear on TV or a panel show or whatever, under every one of their tweets are insults and death threats and rape threats and things like that, which, unless you click on the tweet and you scroll down as a sort of somebody who is following this person, you're not going to see, but they will receive as notifications in, you know, whenever they open their app or on their phone. And so it's a sort of like this, almost this sort of hidden bombardment that seemingly sort of a lot of women in the public eye have just kind of not come to accept, but just have, in order to be in these, on these platforms,
have
no choice. Yeah,
absolutely. And because there is so little accountability for the way people behave online, you know, there needs to be a conversation about, is anonymity the great thing that it was supposed to be at the beginning of the internet? Is it about freedom? Is it the freedom to what? If people are not held accountable for the way they behave online, if they do not have to put their name to things that they say, is that freedom? And whose freedom is that? And is this, you know, if people can behave in ways that would not be acceptable in everyday life, online, or is this really the way that we want society to go? We can't pretend that this isn't now part of society. Mm-hmm. This doesn't exist just in a realm. It's not something people do after dinner for half an hour mm-hmm. before they go on to more erudite pursuits. This is an intimate part of a lot of people's daily life and their interactions. Mm-hmm. And it's not really enough anymore to claim that the freedom to be anonymous is,
yeah.
you know, overrides someone's ability to live in peace.
Mm-hmm. On the subject of pornography, one of the sort of distinctions you make in the essay, and I think drawing on Angela Carter, particularly when she was writing about the Marquis de Sade, is that sort of distinction between meat and flesh. And again, this was something which I had not found sort of articulated in, for example, in discussion of online pornography or advertising or the way that women are perceived in society. But as soon as you sort of outlined the sort of the difference and the way that these two words, which are often, which could in certain contexts be used interchangeably, but in fact they carry such profoundly different connotations for you know, the manner that they're used.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I thought when I came across this in Carter's De Sade book, it was like a light went on in my head. I thought, oh, this is a really useful way to talk about objectification. Mm-hmm. How is the woman in this situation being treated? How is her body being treated? Is it meat or is it flesh? And yes, we often think of those words meaning the same thing, but when you start to delve down into it, you realize that, of course, you know, meat is not something that we refer to human bodies mm-hmm. as. We consider ourselves to be flesh. And if we use the term meat, it is very specifically to make a point about mm-hmm. Objectification or the dehumanization in some way. Mm-hmm. And yet you see all over the media images of women that are completely dehumanized. And I think once you see that there is a difference between meat and flesh, it's very clear. It kind of sorts a lot of stuff out in terms of, is this an objectifying thing or is this not? Does this body belong to a person, a sentient person, someone mm-hmm. who has an emotional life and who has hopes and dreams for herself, who has a child at home and a mother in the nursing home she has to go and visit once a week? Is this a person who thinks about the world? And what do we know of that as we look at her boobs in this tiny bikini? It's, you know, and I'm so, in a way, it sort of ruined a lot of movie watching for me, because you know, you kind of look at it and you think, oh, why is that? What's that doing there? Why am I looking at this at this moment? Why is this sex mm-hmm. scene happening in this place? Why are we looking at this woman's body in this way? What has this to do with her character? Mm-hmm. What has this to do with the forward motion of the plot? Or are we just looking at an object here because mm-hmm. it's nice to look at naked women? And more often than not, of course, that is the simplest but the truest rationale, is that we're looking because we like to look, because it's titillating, mm-hmm. because it's being offered to us on a plate, and this is not there for any other purpose. So yeah, I think Angela Carter kind of nailed that one very, very mm-hmm. nicely, and has you know, it's been tucked away in her De Sade book, I think, and maybe not given the interest that it deserves.
Mm-hmm. One other sort of it's not exactly a sort of a distinction that you make or you unpick in the book, but it's one I'd just like to ask about, because it struck me when I was going back through my notes rather than when I was reading the first time, is that you do talk about at moments you talk about the body of the girl, and then you talk about the body of the woman. And so there's, for example, you're talking about the first manifestation of shame. And you say, you know, there's little ambiguity about the place of its first manifestation, the body, and specifically the body of the girl. Can I just ask just for a bit of clarification? Are we talking about the sort of, do you think there is a distinction in the sort of the way that the sort of, let's say, the prepubescent sort of girl child is viewed with disgust and is imbibed with shame? And then there's a, once women go through, the girls go through puberty and become women, and then certainly as they age as women, there's a kind of a shift in the nature of the disgust, or is it something which, you know, is sort of grows throughout the life, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think the point about the body of the girl is that it is seen as the first battlefield. This is not necessarily an object of disgust in itself, but it is the place where disgust first starts to be, notions of self-disgust start to be channeled, where mm-hmm. children are, you know, surrounded by incredibly sexualized, objectified images of women, where children's programs until recently catered very little for interesting female characters, complex mm-hmm. female characters, that male characters outnumber them and are always in the kind of the central adventure mode. And mm-hmm. and that's only really started to change in the last 10 years or so.
And even then, you mentioned Paw Patrol, I think, with sort of six dogs and only one of them.
And only one of them is a girl. Female, and she's in pink with pink bows. Mm. Which, you know, infuriates me because, you know, Paw Patrol is a great tool if you have a small child. you just wish that it she didn't have to choose. She mm-hmm. was able to choose more. Or, you know, I think when I was a girl, I spent a lot of time identifying with male characters because there were mm-hmm. no female characters that I identified with. And it took me a long time to realize that even if I identified with them, I would still not be considered to be in that league. Mm-hmm. It didn't really matter if I felt like I was Huckleberry Finn or whoever, because I wasn't and I would never be. And I was mm-hmm. outside of that world. And so I think, you know, it's a dangerous place because the pressures are high. Pink clothes are everywhere. Mm-hmm. The princess business is forced down every throat at all times. And it's difficult for women to combat the pressure. I mean, it's hard for an adult woman to reject notions of what she should be, and almost impossible to protect a young child from those images and from those pressures. And when, even if they're not being directly exerted upon her, just growing up in that milieu, growing up in that all-pervasive atmosphere of this is what a girl is, does, looks like, sounds like, behaves. And making girls, I think, afraid of what's coming mm-hmm. for their bodies, of the changes that will happen, of the life that they will be going towards, because, you know, no little girl looks at, you know, the pressures of grown women, and especially when you're trying to teach a child to have her own voice, to reject those kind of images, they then become increasingly aware of the pressures that the adults around them, the adult women around mm-hmm. them, are under, and that in its turn, you know, makes them fearful of what their own futures will be. So it's a very, you know, it's a really difficult tightrope to walk, to constantly assure a child that she can be what she wants, and that she can reject these pressures if she wants, while not frightening her. She will become overwhelmed, and not putting her in a position where she feels like she has to fight every minute of every day.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that's sort of pernicious about a lot of the culture that is available to us. And I think it's changing a little bit, but only a little bit, you go into this in the book, is that it's not only the fact that sort of girls and women are presented with sort of few let's say complex characters to identify with or to aspire to, but a lot of the male characters, there's also a fixed form of how men should be. And I mean, the archetype of the alpha male. And so it's not, there's this kind of this dual exclusion in a way. It's sort of saying, you know, it's excluding women completely because you will never be able to occupy this role. And for, I mean, in my experience, like a large amount of men, it's also saying sort of, this is the standard to which you have to try and operate. You know, this is, you have to work in this kind of, this sort of aggressive, this sort of adventurous, this kind of outgoing, this domineering fashion. Or, you know, there's not the sort of the complex, sensitive, emotional male characters either for little boys. So there's this kind of this double failing in a sense.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I think that runs through right through life, is that I think mm-hmm. men are also trapped inside stereotypes that are not necessarily of their own choosing, mm-hmm. and also, you know, are increasingly objectified, perhaps. But I think, I mean, the problem is that complexity that you want, that multiplicity of self that everyone experiences really in their own life, that they can be, you know, the loud and outspoken angry person, they can be the shy and withdrawn person, they can, mm-hmm. you know, want to wear a nice dress and then want to wear a pair of cowboy boots. And all of these things are just stuff that goes on and moves through us in our life. All the aspects of ourself that we want to pursue, the part of me that is angry, or the part of me that is afraid, the part of me that is outspoken, the part of me that is ashamed, is, you know, it is hard to harness power mm-hmm. over that. And so that is why it is not considered to be acceptable, I think, mm-hmm. why it has not been traditionally acceptable. That if we have two very separate roles, one for men, one for women, these are the things that they do. Everyone has a place, everyone is in a place, and if they don't like that place, those people get to be kept in that place against mm-hmm. their will. And, you know, and the world has changed and people are changed. And in mm-hmm. some ways that has been one of the benefits of social media, but also the backlash against it is also, you know, very prevalent in social media. But yeah, complexity is not encouraged, alas, I think.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. But there was one thing, I suppose this is a sort of a nice point on which to end the conversation. Not that I think this conversation is by no means ended. I think this is a conversation which, as you say at the you know, towards the end of the book, you say, you know, I don't think there's only one answer, and you know, that's the point. It's not sort of something which is going to be sorted out in an hour long podcast. But looking to the future and looking at that kind of patriarchal framework that has existed and persisted for so long, and that is being, you know, that is being kind of redefined and reshaped, but perhaps you know, that's more sort of unfortunately tinkering at the edges rather than sort of deeply sort of uprooting some of the things that holds it in place. I suppose my final question is about that sort of your hope or your sort of vision for the future. Like, do you think that it is possible even to sort of deconstruct that framework from within that framework and to build something new and better sort of on its ruins, so to speak? Or is that a sort of maybe a bit of a sort of a utopian view? Like, once you're kind of, you know, locked in it, is it even possible to think outside of it, having been so sort of completely defined within it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very tricky because, of course, you know, utopian thinking is where no one's permitted to think about utopia anymore. Everything is only dystopia. But the truth is, change has happened. Mm-hmm. And worlds have changed. Countries have changed. People have changed. The universe renews itself. Everything can be different. And it might, the problem is, it's not going to happen tomorrow because you write an angry tweet to someone today. Mm-hmm. it is about accepting a slow process, and that, you know, should the revolution happen tomorrow, will women suddenly be treated any differently? No. You know, it will be the same. It's an evolutionary process rather mm-hmm. than a revolutionary process. But I think, and part of that, and we can all play our part in it, is with an alertness and an awareness, with an ability to look further than the thing that we have been told, deeper into that, to imagine a different solution, to understand that maybe the problem is not what we think it is, but might come from another angle, may come from a different place. And, you know, I mean, disgust was not something that I felt when I was a child that I kind of knew much about, that I was aware of, but I feel incredibly aware of it as a woman in my 40s. And that changes my interaction with the world. It changes the behavior I'm prepared to accept. And it changes the way that I dole out what I want to say in the world as well. But I too do not indulge in a simple, quiet shaming.
Yeah.
And everyone can do that. That's not just, you know, men doing it to women. Women can do it to each other as well. And that's also part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And to be alert and aware. But I do think, I don't know, I'm very bored with the whole everything's ruined, nothing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
That this is, you know, this has been going on for millennia. Everything's ruined and nothing happens, the end of the world. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but we're alive now and we can do things differently and we can make change, and there is precedent for that. That's not a fantasy. But it is accepting the boring, tedious nature of change, progressive, constant, pushing forward and not running to the finish line and expecting everything to be fine tomorrow.
I think that's a perfect place for us to leave it. Thank you so much, Ema. Something Out of Place is, of course, available in store at Shakespeare and Company. It's available from our website. You can find the link in the show notes to this podcast. All that remains for me to say, Ema McBride, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Since you've made it this far, I hope that means you've enjoyed what you've heard and will consider rating us in whatever app you're using. The theme music is Mr. Ginger by the incredible jazz musician Alex Freiman, taken from his album Play It Gentle. I'll be back next week. Until then, take care, happy reading, and thanks again for listening.